The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Ulster Bank, where our business experts get to know you, not just your business. Find out more at ulsterbank.ie/businessmatters.
Well, my first guest today is a man who built his reputation on the rugby field, but his career since retiring in 2009 has had just as much drama. Frankie Sheehan was a stalwart in the number 2 jersey at Munster for 13 seasons before injury forced him to bronze his boots at 32 years old. And he had also earned 29 international caps for Ireland in that time. Post-retirement, he has kept himself busy with some of the things you might typically see from a former sportsman, like television punditry or acting as an agent for current players. But he's also been very active as a businessman in his own right. An ill-fated venture into the property market saw him going through bankruptcy following years of litigation with Bank of Ireland. But he's also established the company Front Row Speakers to supply well-known people to deliver speeches at corporate events. And this venture led to him founding the annual Pendulum Summit in Dublin, which has seen thousands flock to hear motivational talks on business and self-improvement from the likes of Richard Branson, astronaut Chris Hadfield, Joe Malone and Deepak Chopra. This September, the Pendulum Summit will be taking its first tentative steps onto the international stage as he holds his first gathering in New York City. And Frankie Sheehan joins us now from our Cork studio. Frankie, when it came to growing up as a kid, in your mind, was playing rugby to a serious level always on the cards for you?
Yeah, Richard, I think that there's a sport for everybody, I believe, out there. It doesn't mean you're going to be top in the world in that particular sport, but there's a sport that you're going to be better at than all the other sports. And I was very lucky. I came from a family. We did athletics, we played tennis, we played every different type of sport, probably hurling, football, everything. And the one sport I actually never played was rugby. And one day, a friend of mine, a neighbour, Ger Cusson, was going to Cork Con training and said, do you want to go down? And I jumped in the back of the car, and from that day, I knew this was my sport. It was the sport I was way better at than any other sport, and I was running through people and there was physical contact and I adored it. And so from that moment on, it was my calling, if you like, loving rugby, really.
You present it as being almost accidental and quite casual. I've visions of a sort of a Forrest Gump scene where the guy gets the ball and he's not sure of the rules and he just keeps running and running and running and he's a natural talent.
Well, I think that's the beauty about rugby, actually. You don't have to be out and out talented. There's some people say it was William Webb Ellis invented the game. Others say that there was 4 years between each Olympics, and in between that time you had all the shot putters, you had the high jumpers, you had the sprinters and the long, all the different shapes and sizes were sitting around, and they said, what are we going to do for the next 4 years? And somebody came up with this idea of rugby, because what other sport could you see in my time, a Peter Stringer standing beside a Devon Toner? You know, it just looks totally incongruous, if you like. And guys like John Hayes, you've every different shape and size, and that's what makes rugby so great. And you've certain people on the field mightn't even touch the ball for a whole game, which is very unusual in a ball sport.
And still have a good match.
Yeah, and still play a good game, which is most unusual.
Now, for you, obviously, you had tremendous talent and aptitude for it. You went on to play for Munster for 13 seasons, 29 caps for Ireland. So that was a source, I presume, of great personal pride and a sense that, you know, I've really arrived.
Well, it just, as luck happened, I was hugely into, you talked about going back 30 years ago, I was into personal development, I was into self-help books. I remember listening to creative visualization tapes with guys like Tony Quinn and Tony Robbins and all these guys. And when I found rugby, I absolutely adored it. I was lucky to go to a great rugby playing school then in Presentation Cork. And of course, who was my teacher and who had me for 6 years in school was Declan Kidney. And then it just had a natural progression. I won Junior Cup and we won a Senior Cup and got involved in Irish schools. And as luck happened, and my mother reckons I had it written down in some sheet that she found years after, that I wanted to play rugby professionally, whether it was rugby league or rugby union. But as luck happened, the game became professional in 1995, and I finished my economics degree in UCC in 96, and I went straight in more or less to a part-time rugby playing contract. So it was my absolute dream coming true. Here I was getting paid to play the game I absolutely adore. So it was just, it all happened for me, and it was just an amazing to do that with some of your best friends.
Now, to get into the world of business and money, at that time you were a professional player, you were at the top of your game. What kind of advice were people giving you about how to plan for the future, and were you taking it on board?
I was very lucky, Richard, in that I have a father who was an entrepreneur and a real businessy guy all the time. He had us always working in summer jobs, and he did a lot of, you know, he had pubs and nightclubs as part of his portfolio. He had residential property, commercial property, and he'd do a lot of it direct labour, so we'd be filling skips and the pubs and nightclubs. I'd be collecting glasses, and, you know, when I was about 16, 17, myself and my two younger brothers, we'd pubs and nightclubs. So we used to see the foreign students coming over, and they'd be all around Cork. And we said, well, why don't we set up our own disco from 7:30 to 10 o'clock? Because the senior disco would start after, the adult disco would start at 10:30. And we started it, and year one was very challenging. But as luck happened, our competitor closed down the following year, and we had, 2,000 on a Tuesday, 2,000 on a Thursday, and probably 600 on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 8 weeks of the summer. It was absolutely incredible. Our overheads was one senior doorman, maybe one DJ, and a few of my mates were just helping out in the door. It was incredible. So I think I was lucky that I always had a kind of a nose for the business side of things through my father. I was always interested. We used to run the discos in school and stuff like that, the Christmas parties and things. It was always kind of involved in that type of thing. I, invested in my first property, which is another story, when I was about 18, through my father's counsel. My father gives me
Where
credit.
Did you get the money to invest in a property at 18?
Yeah, well, if you go back, how long ago is that?
From running the discos and all
when
that.
When I was 80, that's 5 years ago. Is that, I'm only joking, about 23 years ago. Properties weren't that expensive back then, and obviously I had a father that was going to guarantee the loan, and myself and my brother invested in this property, and it actually went very well. It was a good learning curve, and it was near a college at the time, and it was rented out directly, and it just worked very, very well, and we got on the property ladder from an early age.
Now, you hung up the boots when you were 32, and you were due to go to a French club, but an injury had really got in the way of that, so it was time to move on. But at that stage, having that eye towards business, having made investments and been interested in investing in property, what kind of investments did you have, or what were your plans for the future?
Yeah, so I suppose going back to probably a question which overlaps, I think, with this that you asked earlier, is the advice I was given, I suppose, at the time was, look, this is going to end at some point soon. It's not like another job. It's not like you retire when you're 60 and you have your pension. So I was very much motivated to create a pension for myself. And the advice that everybody was giving and the experts were saying, and all the most successful business people I could see, were all investing in property. And this thing just was never going to end. And being a professional player, and I was quite resourceful when it came to contacts. I'd met some of the big developers and good guys, and guys like Michael O'Flynn, and we'd sort of be on to Michael, and Michael, what's happening in the next phase, and we'd buy a couple of properties from him. And the idea was that when I retired and others like me, that we would have some form of a pension that we weren't going to retire for good, but at least it would take the pressure off. And that was the key thing, really. And I thought I was investing wisely. And when I look back, really, I mean, things were going up. And I think we all can be very hard on ourselves. And, when I look back at that whole phase, my error, I guess, was, and I hope I've learned from it, and time will tell that story, is I had no exit strategy. And,
Frankie, you had a portfolio of properties. Did you have many properties, and what sort of borrowings did you have against that?
Yeah, there was like ballpark, about a dozen properties, residential properties, and the borrowings were about 3.5 million roughly against those, So it was, this was the time of crazy stuff, 100 110% mortgages at times, Richard, you know. And it was there was no sort of... there was no real plan B. It was this thing was going to go. If there was a dip, people were saying, you know, it might drop 20, 30%, but it'll be fine. But sure, look, nobody could have predicted probably what was going to happen next. But either way, I like to think that if I was doing something along those lines again, that I'd be saying, right, what is my long-term strategy here? I'm not just going to let float along and let this thing go. I need to treat it like a proper business. What is my exit strategy? What are the... And if there is, and if there is... What's the downside? What is the downside of investing? And are you able for the downside if it does happen? So I think I've learned the lessons anyway, you know.
And eventually, like so many people who were caught up in that kind of situation when the property market crashed, creditors came after you, Bank of Ireland came after you because there was a shortfall between what you owed and the value of the assets.
We were very unlucky, Richard, that it was Bank of Ireland. And, you know, I have lots of very good friends in Bank of Ireland to this day. And we were, you know, great customers of them. My father's still one of their, a very, very big client of theirs. And but they just had, and whoever it was, maybe the time, Richie Boucher, just decided on the Bank of Ireland mortgages side that there was an absolute zero tolerance. That was number one. And number two was that Frank Senior, my father, had some personal guarantees involved. So from their point of view, they saw this and, oh, there's security there. So they probably went more aggressive at us on the back of that. They wanted to get, you know, seize the security, if you like. And you know, in the early stages, I'm sure if you'd one of them on, Richard, they'd be saying... We you know, we were quite aggressive back maybe at the start, and we probably were, because we were fighting. I was fighting for my life, and I was going to do anything I could. I have five small kids, and you know, it was, you know, finished rugby. This was it. The world was ending, and you know, in the early stages of that, we had to do whatever it was, and they were, Frank Senior was behind, and he was under, he was, you know, thanks be to God, he's come through and he's fine now, but he was under a lot of pressure. And if we had folded, you know, there could have been a lot of trouble for him as well.
People who have faced that kind of situation, and there are many of them over the last 10 years and have been through that, some of them, I think, maybe don't want to get out of bed in the morning and they want to pull the duvet over their head and just try and hope that it will all go away. Others seem to get into an energised, I'm going to fight this, I'm going to do everything I can kind of mode. Which were you?
Oh, we engaged 100% with it. I was very lucky. My brother Joey was involved as well. And Joey is a very successful mortgage company in Cork, My Mortgages. And he would have a ferocious attention to detail with all the paperwork associated with all that. And so everything was met absolutely head on. I think the term you're probably referring to is, I think, the ostrich approach. Is it bury the head in the sand is the other one, you know?
Yeah.
And you can see the merit for that too, you know. But I think that can cause a lot of stress, because you saying you're kind of forgetting about it, but you're not really. It's still there in the background, and the letters keep arriving. But Richard, it's no different to, I suppose, any adversity that people have in life and in business. And you have a choice. What do you do? Do you and jump in? I'm the victim here. Poor me. Look at me. You know, or do you just take responsibility? And I've taken 100% responsibility for my investments and for what has happened. It is my fault, and I'm going to blame myself 100%. It's nobody else's fault. I don't harbour any bitterness or any resentment to anybody else. And that's it. You know, you just get on with it and deal with it. And you know, no point in looking in the rear view mirrors. You need to drive things on. And I think everybody has that choice when adversity happens. I'm probably lucky going through the sporting career, and thankful, you know, I suppose when you look back at the successes I've had on the rugby field, I've probably had more, you know, lost some. I remember one year lost three finals in a row, you know, lost Cork Con, we lost to Leinster, and we lost to Leicester.
And that hurts in its own way.
It hurts, and it really does hurt, you know. And I remember after one of the particular games, I was fairly rattled actually, and Declan Kidney pulled me aside and said, "Frankie, you know, you gotta start dealing with this." And I said, "I can't. I'm just gutted, you know." And he sent me to see Declan O'Hearn, the sports psychologist who's works out of UL, and spoke to Declan, and not long into the conversation, Declan said, Frankie, you're going to have to use the 10-yard rule. And I said, what's the 10-yard rule, Declan? And he said, well, Tiger Woods, he said, when he hits a bad shot, he doesn't get over it immediately. He allows himself the time to give out for the time. He puts the club back into the bag and he walks 10 yards. He can bitch, he can moan, he can do whatever he needs to do. But once he walks beyond that 10-yard line, bang, he moves on then immediately. And I think that's, you know, one of the things definitely that would have helped me from the rugby field. It was what it was. It was an extraordinary time, the whole property thing and the crash, some of the properties going down 70%. One of the things I would say, Richard, on it, I mean, I went bankrupt 14 months ago. I've exited bankruptcy about 6 weeks ago. I have to say, I would never, ever advocate somebody walking away from their responsibility and monies they owe when they took out in good faith. I mean, I don't think that's acceptable. However, if you just have come, it's come to a head for whatever reason, and you just tried every avenue to resolve it, I think the Insolvency Service of Ireland, I have to give them an awful lot of credit in how they have implemented a 12-month bankruptcy in this country, which can allow people to get back on their feet and allow them to get back on with their lives and get rid of the stress and worry. So I'm kind of saying two things there. I'm saying if you are in that situation, I would have to say I'd recommend it.
So basically you found yourself, the whole property thing was over. You were still trying to deal with the consequences of that. You were no longer playing rugby. So you're looking around for business opportunities and say, what am I going to do? Now, one of the first things you did was to look at the contacts you had in sport and in the industry. You did media punditry. So you began with things you knew best.
The lads used to slag me all the time, my ex-teammates. Oh, there's Frankie. What's he doing this time? You know, there was a bit of that. I mean, I suppose what they didn't maybe know is that I was fighting for my life back then. And maybe I think they've realised that some of them since. And I was doing media work and I was doing stuff with RTE. I was doing stuff for Sky. I was onto the BBC, BBC Northern Ireland, you name it. I was just doing whatever I could and I was trying to be as good as I could be at that. I set up a company, Front Row Speakers, which had a sports management arm to it at that stage. So I was trying everything, you know, and meeting a lot of these big brands and companies, and I was doing some guest speaking myself, and then they were looking for other people. So I started saying, well, sure, look, I can get those for you. So I was doing a bit of everything. And then a few years later, we just said, look, let's narrow this into a speakers bureau. And that gave us a great insight then into, I suppose, corporate Ireland, but also dealing with a lot of the big companies and the institutes and the associations, finding out what the changing trends were in areas of leadership, high performance, wellness, you know, and we're very much ahead of the curve. And while we were in this, of course, the litigation was going on in the background and my head was hanging a bit. And I remember at one stage standing inside in the kitchen with my wife, and I said to Norm, I said, Norm, we're going to have to do something about this. I feel I need something myself. And she agreed, and she wanted to, you know, not for ourselves, but also for Ireland. I mean, I thought the amount of desperate, wasted time on current affair programmes and litigation and letters going back and forth from, I could just see such dead time. And if you could measure it, I'd say it was in the tens of billions it cost the country, I reckon, going back. What can we do? We said, what can we do that would make this difference? And I suppose by doing all the different industries, and we might have a speaker in Google or Facebook or JP Morgan or AIB or Johnson & Johnson, and all different industries, said, wouldn't it be fantastic to have one event once a year that wasn't just for the pharmaceuticals or the bankers or the agri guys, but for anybody who's in that place of maximising their potential in all aspects of their lives. So it wasn't just your industry guys on your agri, but, and not your touchy-feely ones over here, but a hybrid between both.
Now, the first event, the first Pendulum Summit you did, the Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield spoke at it. How did that come about?
Well, I was actually, Richard, born in Canada. I was, my father's from Cork, my mother was from Dublin. I didn't advertise the Dublin aspect of my connection until well after I had retired from rugby, right?
You sound like you're still coming to terms with it, Frankie.
No, I'm telling everybody about it now because I have lots of great clients up in Dublin, of course. So Chris Hadfield, when you're starting this, I mean, the fees for these guys are enormous, but I was able to get on. I used the Canadian connection and I begged and pleaded, and we paid a substantial check, but it was at a reduced number to what it should have been. And all of a sudden, when you sign a contract there, this thing is live. There's a date and there's a deadline, and it was just, oh my God.
But Chris Hadfield wasn't massively available. You were very restricted in the date.
Yes, that was it. That was part of the reason we got a reduced fee. Is it had to be January the 8th, and I bounced this off a few people and a few potential sponsors, and no, absolutely not, Frankie. There's no way that'll work. It's way too early. There's nothing happening. This has to be at a different day totally. So just went on. We tried it, and that was it. So we said, right, guys, let's just go for it. And we went for it. I think about 3-4 days into it, we had 3 tickets sold, and this was getting very, very worrying. I said maybe we should have listened to the advice, and we just went for it. And I think everybody has a kind of a black book of contacts in their phone. I'll use him someday, and I'll ring him another day. It was time to pull every single one of those out.
Everybody's black book.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I just literally every phone number, every contact I had in my phone, I just unleashed. And did I push it too hard with some people? I'm sure I did. And that's the life, I guess, of an entrepreneur, the life of a salesperson. And it's a very, very, salespeople know, or entrepreneurs know what I'm talking about, handling rejection on an ongoing basis. But most of the people, the 600 people that attended, were probably coerced into going because I sort of emotionally blackmailed them to going, but it absolutely blew them away.
I'm thinking, Frankie, as well about the nature of this business. In a way, there are some parallels with sport and rugby because you can put all of the preparation into this event, huge amounts of organisational hard work, take a financial risk. You still need it all to go right on the day. Are you a bag of nerves coming up to the event, perhaps as you might have been before a big match?
Absolutely. Total bag of nerves altogether. And it is exactly like that. I mean, you train really, really hard. Some of the days now and the weeks we put in the last few weeks now alone, I mean, it's like when you're coaching in whatever sport, not just rugby and GA and hurling, and you're out in that wintry night and you're doing those runs and you're just, your lungs are burning, there's nobody watching, you're miserable, you're cold, you're saying, why am I doing this? And the reward is when you lift that trophy or you win that match and you're having a few pints with your buddies after it. I mean, it's exactly like that. And there's no, you go into this and yeah, things can go wrong. Anything can go wrong. Richard Branson's flight might not land. It might go down. He might have a bereavement in his family. There's a huge risk involved in it, you know. So
how did you find Richard Branson to deal with? Was he personable? Friendly?
Expensive. I want to joke. Richard is the film star of this whole space. I mean, you know, you think of success in life and business, and a picture of Richard jumps into your head. And people wanted Richard for years, and we delivered Richard because everybody wanted Richard. And he's a lovely way about him, and he's living the dream, and he's, you know, he's living that fantasy there. And you know, but like Richard sits up and he'll, you know, answer a few questions and stuff like that. And I suppose there's a massive motivating feeling of being near your idol, you know. If he probably went boo on the day of his, oh my God, isn't he wonderful? You know, there's a bit of that, and so he doesn't need to have the insights as much. But what we do then is we need the Richard Branson to sell the tickets, if you like. It's like a jigsaw. It's getting the big name in. And somebody else I met last night said, you know, James Cann, my God, he was something else, the British Dragon. And somebody else said Paul O'Connell. We had Paul O'Connell, and you know, Paul was talking about mindfulness for stupid rugby players that Joe Schmidt had shared with him. And this just so resonated with people, because we're all thinking mindfulness, we think of, you know, somebody meditating. And but all of a sudden, Paul O'Connell, who is a lot of these guys' hero, who's sort of running around a rugby field and is a real man's man, is talking about mindfulness, and he's saying it in a way that's resonating with people. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful mix of different types of speakers, and different ones resonate with different people.
Now, what about New York? You decided to really go for it. You've brought the Pendulum Summit across the Atlantic. Are there very different expectations because of the market over there?
I'll tell you on the 14th of September. Well, we've had so many of our American speakers over saying, Frankie, my God, why are you not doing this over here? This is outstanding. This is done better than anybody does it over here in America. And I found it kind of hard to believe. And we were over and back at a few conferences, and we had delegates over saying the same thing. And we had people saying you should go to London, go to Amsterdam, go to, you know, Singapore, go to Australia. We had all sorts of Dubai. We looked very seriously at that at one stage. And then we just said, I suppose, on the back of maybe my exiting the bankruptcy, and we looked at some of the key traits that Pendulum is all about, and some of them being, you know, having the can-do attitude, you know, not using excuse-itis, you know, resilience, perseverance, and coupled with all those insights and advice we'd got from speakers, and we said, where's the hardest place? Where's the toughest place we could do this? So New York being so vast and big, we feel that this could be the area and the place where we could have the greatest impact, because as the saying goes, if we make it there, we can make it anywhere, and it'll be easier to bring it back, but also to scale outwards from there, because there's, what, 12 million people in, you know, in the New York area, and we feel that that was the hardest place. That's the toughest, hardest place.
And if it goes very well, and I'm sure it will, Frankie, will you keep Dublin? Will you, you know, branch out further into the United States, or maybe look at doing more in New York while also keeping the Dublin Summit?
We had a wonderful event in Dublin. We had 7,000 people over 2 days. It was absolutely fantastic, and we have absolutely committed to Dublin. There's no reason we would why move it. We've everybody there absolutely loves it. I'd love to see Dublin being our anchor event, and I'm Irish and very proud of being our Irish, and we want this to be the one that everyone talks about, that this is the main one, and the other ones are somewhat satellite events in their own way, but that the real one is the Dublin one, and we'd love to really drive that. It's in a time of the year, Richard, as well. I feel I'm doing my bit for Ireland. I spent 6 years on the board of Fáilte Ireland, and it's the quietest time of the year for business tourism, and we estimated that it generates 20 million the local economy of Dublin in the worst time of the year for tourism. So we feel we're doing our bit there as well, and we're very proud of that.
Now, I can't let you go without asking you about the big game in Bilbao later on today, Leinster and Racing. Who's going to win?
Well, look, I think you just have to look at the bookmakers there, Richard. I think they're showing an 11-point spread in Leinster's favour. It's going to be very hard to see Leinster getting beaten, and I think they deserve it. They've just been knocking on the door. They have an outstanding squad. They've really worked hard. You know, Mick Dawson and Guy Easterby and Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster, they've really, really pulled together a wonderful squad. They absolutely deserve it. I think Racing probably played their final against Munster in the semi-final. If I was calling it, I couldn't really look beyond Leinster, and let's hope. Look, at the end of the day, you know, when I was playing, I absolutely hated Leinster. but this is good for Ireland. It'll be fantastic for Ireland. I'll absolutely be shouting for Leinster later on today.
Well, Frankie Sheehan, founder of the Pendulum Summit, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you so much, Richard.